Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy. My guest on the show today is Charlie Bethel, owner of Plus Construction. After years of endless callbacks, cash crunches, and frustration, Charlie overhauled both his marketing and production systems and optimized them in such a way that he could not only sell, but build over 500 projects a year. Now, this conversation focuses specifically on his digital marketing strategies, which provides 60% of the overall lead flow every year, and the massive changes that he's made to his sales to production handoff that have allowed Plus Construction to do the volume that they do. So without further ado, let's dive in with Charlie. You're listening to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy, where we systemize contracting businesses for growth. Keep listening to learn how the world's top contractors scale their companies, build killer teams, and make more while working less. Charlie, welcome to the show, man. It's great to have you.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for inviting me.
I'm excited to have this conversation because you have figured out how to basically sell and produce 500 jobs a year. And by the way, this is a discretionary item. This is something, and I'll let you kind of explain to the audience in a second what it is exactly you guys do, but this is not... You know, you're not installing roofs, you're not doing AC units where the customer's hand is forced. This is we could categorize this more as a want to have than a need to have. And you figured out a way to optimize both your sales and marketing and your production systems to do that kind of volume, which we all think is really impressive and want to talk to you about. So why don't you just start by telling us a little bit about your business and in particular, like the actual product that you guys install?
Sure. So the company's called Plus Construction. We're based in the greater Vancouver area, lower mainland of British Columbia, Canada. We are a specialty builder of outdoor living spaces. Specifically, we build decks, pergolas, and patio covers. So that's it. We have like a very narrow range of products that we sell and install. And yeah, they're very much a want to have product rather than the product.
What is the average job size of those things? Like when you track at the end of the year, can you tell us the AJS? What's the average ticket?
Our AJS is right now, it's running around 15,000. It did drop down like in the 2 years post COVID to about 12,000, but it's jumped back up to 15,000 now, which is what it was pre COVID. So 15,000, but you have to take that with a bit of a pinch of salt. There's lots of $3,000 projects that we do, and lots of $60,000-$70,000 projects.
Okay, 15K average job size with kind of a wide variance. Let's say some smaller ones, yeah, and some really big ones. And then like roughly what size is your business now in terms of revenue?
Revenue wise, for this year, we should do $6.5 million.
So
that's our goal target.
$6.5 million. Do the math on that. It's a lot of jobs. There's really two sides to this business that I think I and the whole audience are going to find really, really interesting. One is like the marketing and sales system. That's a lot of leads and a lot of estimates and a lot of closed jobs to get that kind of volume. And then the other is like the production side. We need to go out and make these things. And you have like very strategically over the years kind of built up both sides of the business to be where it is now, where it can handle that kind of volume. Let's start with the marketing side of things. You have quite an impressive digital marketing funnel set up. Walk us through it at a high level to begin, and then I'm going to have some follow-up questions for you.
Okay, well, right now, we've actually moved in the last year to working with WebRunner. So WebRunner is an agency that deals with digital marketing, and we advertise with them through Google Ads, Facebook, and Bing, and Instagram, I guess, Facebook and Instagram together. So we generate raw appointments with them and use a speed to lead system to encourage bookings sales appointments with our sales team.
Did you set up this funnel in the first place and then hand it off to WebRunner, or were they the ones to kind of engineer it in the first place?
No, we definitely set it up ourselves to start off with. And actually, there are a few years where Facebook was like our main revenue driver. So we would post pretty pictures and videos on Facebook and generate leads out of that, out of the leads, generate appointments and appointments out of sellers.
Now, a lot of contractors are pretty reluctant to invest in digital marketing. I would say marketing more broadly, but digital marketing specifically, they've had some bad experiences. Maybe they, you know, did some, you know, unsuccessful Facebook campaigns or Instagram campaigns, and then they decide it's not for them. You made the decision to really invest in this as a core part of your overall strategy. When did you decide to do that, and what was sort of going on in your business that made you feel compelled enough to see this through and build this out?
Well, I mean, in the early days of the business, you know, we have pretty small and humble roots, definitely. But we used to rely on flyer advertising a lot, along with like home shows and trade shows. We still operate a lot of home shows and trade shows, and we love them, and we put a lot of effort into those. But What we're always finding is we would get lots of work and then run out of work, and then get lots of work and then run out of work while you're waiting for flyers to be mailed out, or while you're waiting for the next show to come in. And we weren't getting a consistent enough flow of leads and sales to warrant any kind of overhead. So that's when we decided really to focus on digital marketing and fill the gaps in. Be able to turn it on and off and generate business that way.
Were there any early lessons that you found in the way that you did targeting, the platforms that you used, the creatives that you made, the ads that you came up with that led to some early success for a lot of business owners, us included, Breakthrough Academy included, by the way? It you know, it was truly stumbling around a minefield for a number of years until we figured out the right recipe, the right concoction. Hey, this is our audience on Facebook. These are the types of things that people click on. This is a landing page that we should send them to. And we're still learning a lot, but it took us a little while. What was that early stage of setting up the campaign like for you?
I think like the biggest lessons were learned more with it in the Google Ads space than Facebook. We did struggle with both, but with Google Ads in particular, It's very easy to burn all your money very quickly. So I remember there was we were first trying out the Google Ads, and I ran a campaign for a weekend. So I had $1,000 saved up, and I thought, right, we need to get some jobs, otherwise we're gonna start losing some people. Let's do a Google Ads campaign and get it set up. So I set up my main keyword, or my main keyword sets, as deck builder, which sounds relevant. We build decks, and that shouldn't be a problem.
Makes sense.
However, that's also like a major term for online gaming and poker as well. And
right.
We spent the whole budget in 2 days and got zero leads. That was really tough. It was tough even working out what happened. You know, if you don't know what you're doing, like it's hard to see what happened. And you have to be like really careful with that.
So you had a bunch of leads come through your system who were interested in, I don't even know what that term, do you know what that term is in the context of video games?
Well, not even leads. It's just they clicked, right? So they were clicking on, they were looking to build their deck on their online game, and they were clicking on a deck builder and then thinking, oh, that's not right, and just closing and moving on.
What have you guys figured out work? So, I mean, obviously that's a question of like you got the wrong keyword or not specific enough. What have you guys learned about like the creative, the graphic, the ad? Like what do people in your market click on? What have you moved towards, and what have you moved away from in terms of copy, in terms of creative?
Sure. I mean, I think one of the reasons why we had good success on Facebook and Instagram was because our product is very visual. So we'd find that we could really post nice, pretty pictures of what we do on Facebook and Instagram, and it's going to get some attention. So that's like the good part of it, which is like really for our business is a little bit more unique than a lot of other building companies. This is a very visual product. I think more recently we really need to work on, and everyone needs to work on video a lot more, and make sure that like high quality video on ads seems to be getting more attention than straight
images,
photographs these days. Yeah. Images, yeah,
that's right.
So we're definitely moving in that direction as well, and we want to continue having successful campaigns.
On these, what are basically Google Ads campaigns, people click on it. What does it push them to? Is this just a well-designed landing page featuring a bunch of your work?
Well, yeah, but actually what I'm trying to get to with doing all of this marketing is the one unique thing that we did was to really try and get the customer to book a sales appointment online or at the point of interaction. So as soon as we have their details, we're asking them to book an appointment, and we're asking them to do it at their convenience at a time that works well for them, and we're trying to accommodate that. With Facebook in particular, Facebook is really good at mining data from their consumers. So they have like autofill forms, for example. So if you run a lead generation campaign with Facebook, it's very easy to get 100 customers' names and addresses and phone numbers, but getting hold of them afterwards is really, really tricky, and lots of people complain about that. It's not that there's no interest in the product. There is, but getting them on the phone from a number they don't know and don't trust, and at the right time of day, and you know, all of these things added up just means that you get such a low rate of return if you're just generating lists of leads. So we really found success with using that, using an online booking tool. So as soon as we have their information, we're then asking them, hey, when's a good time for us to come?
Mm. So you, through trial and error, figured out that the right action that you want the potential customer to take is to book an appointment that fits their schedule basically right away. Like you're not pushing them to call into a phone number. You're not pushing them to just submit some information so that you can call them. The desired outcome for your guys' business is for them to basically self-schedule themselves into your guys' calendar, correct?
Yeah, 100% correct.
And go ahead.
Yeah, we found the biggest success with that. So yeah, we used to go for phone calls. We used to advertise specifically with the phone number, give us a call now, and do Google Ad campaigns, you know, with phone numbers. But we found we get much better results from people setting up an appointment.
Okay. Now, one of the things on this journey of sort of figuring this out, we talked offline, you had mentioned that one part of the secret sauce here is to actually you made an intentional decision to not qualify people as closely. So by that, I mean, you know, many businesses, especially in the home service space, mid-average job size space, would be taught to qualify very closely. Do you have a budget? Do you have a time frame? What color do you want? Are you getting other quotes? Have you been thinking about this a while? There's all these qualifying questions that we, the business, make the prospect or make the lead answer to ensure that we're essentially not wasting our time. And that's not necessarily a bad idea, but you guys have chosen not to do that. And I wonder if you can explain why.
Well, there's a few reasons. Firstly, we try to have a range of products that will fit most people's budgets and most people's homes. So we have, you know, we have a $3,000 product that is going to look good on really any home. We also have a $60,000 product, which is going to look great on a mansion. It doesn't matter how nice the house is, it's still going to look great. So we have like a whole range of products available for the customer. So really, as long as they own a home and they are within, they're not children, really, we want to see them. And my way of thinking is that if you can get a highly motivated, skilled, and knowledgeable salesperson into someone's house that is interested in a product, then you have a good chance of getting a deal and moving forward and doing business together.
But is part of it not the fact that when you're doing digital marketing online, there's a much lower level of trust? And so if you start peppering these people with 80 questions about what's your timeline and what's your budget, they're not going to complete the form fill and you're never going to get that lead, correct? Like that's the other side of it too.
100%. And actually, like we go almost the other way, where we don't even like to send reminders out to customers of their upcoming appointment.
How come?
Because we don't want them to cancel. If you make it easy for them to cancel, they will.
Right.
So it's really common for like a customer on a Thursday afternoon or a Friday afternoon to book an appointment online and say, oh yeah, I'll see them next week. And then Monday comes around, they've had the whole weekend, and then Monday they're busy and they get a reminder text saying, hey, just so you know, we're coming to see you at 6 p.m. And they text back saying, yeah, I actually can't do it today. And then good luck getting hold of them again. That happens. It happens all the time. And
have you tested that? Or is that just like an anecdotal? Is that just like your sense of it? Like, is that something you...
I mean, we're testing it right now. We're testing it by removing all of the reminders. But what we're looking at is no-shows on appointments. And there's around 1 in 30 no-shows right now.
That's so it. Like
it's pretty rare. Yeah.
1 in 30.
Now, there is a bit of outside influence with that because quite often, like, our sales reps will call a customer and make sure they're home and make sure they're all organized for their upcoming appointment with them. But the idea is to just remove any easy cancellation opportunities that they have.
So how many hours before the appointment are they making that phone call? Is it like a manual phone call? The sales rep actually just gives them a buzz an hour before they drive out or something?
That's right. It is normally when they're on their way and they finish their last appointment. And quite often they don't. They just show up.
That's really interesting. And it's sort of counterintuitive. Most digital marketing people would say you want to send a bunch of reminders to increase the show up rate, but you're saying you're just giving people easy outs because on most of these automated texts, and you would, you know, if you're, you go to your dentist, you're going to get a reminder and it says, oh, do you need to reschedule? And you can literally click the button and reschedule. You want to remove the opportunities to do that. Your sense of it is that works better for you guys.
That's correct.
What percentage of your overall revenue, your overall sales comes from this lead source, this online, this digital marketing lead source versus others?
Right now, it's about 60%. Mm. So a significant amount. It's not all of it. We do, and it's actually, it's quite difficult to track. So we get a significant amount of business from displaying at home shows and trade shows. Which is a really good, we find it's a really good method of booking appointments. So we have the same mentality with that. We go in there, we're not there to give out business cards or leaflets or phone numbers. We're there to book appointments. So our sales team are going in there, talk to the customer, right, when can I come to your home and give you a proper quote. So we get about 40% of our business from home shows. But there is definitely like a mix and a gray area between, because a lot of people will find us at home shows and then they will Google us later and then they'll be caught up in the digital side of the marketing. And that we know that happens quite a lot.
Charlie, can I ask you, you guys do 60% of your revenue through this. You only have a no-show rate of about 1 in 30, which seems like too good to be true. Do you guys, how do you sell the value of the estimate of the salesperson coming over to their house? Because, look, I think most homeowners know that, like, free estimate is just a term for some dude is going to come to my house and give me a sales pitch and I'm going to awkwardly say no, or let me think about it, or I'm going to cave and I'm going to buy something. Like, a lot of people are scared to be sold to. So my question is, you have found success with down this avenue. There's obviously something that you've done that in the offer, in the copy, in the description, you are persuading people either explicitly or implicitly that this thing, this appointment is really valuable, and it's something that you A, want enough to schedule, and B, want enough to show up for. Is there anything you guys have done to, like, the offer around the estimate that you think has led to that success?
I mean, I don't think there's anything that's 100% specific. Our speed to lead sequence is, it's fast and it's quite friendly. So it's almost casual. We're saying, okay, so this sales rep is gonna come and see you on this date, and we can have a chat and a coffee and just talk about your project. And that's really the way we deal with this at home shows and trade shows as well. It's rather than inviting ourselves for a formal sales presentation, where it's going to be serious and there's going to be a 1 hour closing session at the end, like some kind of timeshare deal. We try to keep it a lot more casual than that and say, okay, Colin's in the area on Thursday at 2:00. Is it okay if he swings by on that date? And it seems to generally work for us.
So if someone was in a position like you used to be in, where you had work and then you run out and then you have some more and then you run out, and they're wanting to really stabilize their inbound, their sales and their revenue stream, what three mistakes, give me two even, like what are some key mistakes that you would encourage them to avoid making if they were going to build out a funnel like you have?
Mistake one is not getting help when we really should. So you should make sure you get professional help. It doesn't necessarily have to be with a super expensive agency or big commitments, but getting someone to help you set up your plans and your campaigns is really important, because you genuinely can burn money really quickly and really easily. Another mistake is not being able to handle both the production side and the lead volume. So if you're doing a campaign and you're generating lots of leads, you've actually got to be able to service those leads and in good time. Like, it's no good generating a lead and then not being able to see them for 2 weeks. So you've got to have the people and the capacity in place to handle it. And the same goes on the production side. You can sell a project, but you can't do it for 6 months. You're gonna lose a lot of those guys, and there's no point in running the campaign in the first place.
It really is quite a balancing act, quite an orchestration to have both of those sides of your business in sync. You have made really tremendous strides. This is a good segue into the production side of it. Made really big strides on what we would call your sales to production handoff. Before we talk about what you were going through and what you fixed and how it is now, can you maybe give some thoughts on why, in general, contractors really seem to struggle with this sales to production handoff in their business?
Well, I think if we look at it from the sales side first, especially in direct sales, which is what we do, what a lot of companies do is direct selling. There's a lot of imagination and a lot of emotion going on, and it's all sunshine and rainbows. And we're thinking about how much more beautiful we're going to make your house or your backyard, and how great it's going to be, how you're going to enjoy it with your family in the summertime. And it's all great. And there's a big difference between that and the reality of building and construction, right? It's noisy, it's smelly, and it goes on for a long time, and it's not particularly comfortable for anyone involved. So there's a disconnect between those two things. And going straight from the sales presentation into production is really rough, on the customers. There's also, with so much imagination going on, especially with the customers, is contractors don't necessarily know what's in their head. And that's a problem. Because if the end project doesn't become what they were imagining, then they're not going to be happy. And quite often there's too much selection, too much choice, and it's just not specific enough for them to understand exactly what's going to happen and what's going on.
So you think a lot of it is around expectation setting with the customer and sort of setting up a situation where there's many opportunities for disappointment downstream.
100%.
There's also the other side of it, which is just though like the logistical operational part. And so you had mentioned offline the state of things really before you figured this out and invested in all the stuff we're going to talk about, from standard estimating to SOPs and what have you. You were telling me about a huge number of callbacks because sales to production was very sloppy, cash flow issues because you're not getting paid when you would expect to be paid because you're doing the callbacks, so it's your payment terms are getting extended out, and then team morale was sort of at an all-time low. You want to just talk about the state of things before you fix this?
Yeah, I mean, this is really what it was like. The business was like this when I first joined ETA. My job was the fireman. So I was putting out the fires every day on every site, constantly. That's all I was doing. So customers being upset with timelines, with money, with change orders, with color choices, with things being done wrong, things being put in the wrong place. Like it was bad. It was really bad. And I'm sure everyone understands that. But even as a young company, we were still doing it, you know, maybe 100 or 200 projects a year. That's a lot of headaches to have. And your cash flow can really be, really take a hammer when some of those people withhold payment or don't want to pay and they're not satisfied.
And what did you notice with what did you notice around team morale with this? Like, just people were obviously down and feeling in the dumps about the constant issues.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard, and we definitely in the early days we lost some really good people. Nobody wants to work for a company where the customers are mad. Mm. And one of the big issues we had was we quite often were getting delayed. So if we were delayed starting a project and we're starting it 2 weeks late, the installers or the guys on site, they had no chance of doing a nice job for a happy customer. They were mad before we'd even started.
Right.
And so it didn't matter how hard they worked and how good a job they did, the customer's still going to be upset at the end. And that was tough. And we lost a few people and really realized that things had to change in order to work.
So you mentioned three things. You mentioned standardized estimating and forms. You talk a lot about pre-construction meetings, and you talked a lot about SOPs, these being sort of like the three antidotes to your specific sales to production handoff issues. But I think a listeners can learn and maybe just extrapolate this to their own business. Let's start with the standardized estimating and forms. as far as the estimating goes, I mean, what were you doing before? Was it napkin quotes?
Not quite napkin quotes, but I mean, it was all technology. It was, we were writing the quotes on carbon copy paper, and, you know, with a description of the project and description of the colors of the project. And, it was a written quote, handwritten quote with a drawing and a price. Like, that's how we were doing it. And it's not like it was completely wild. I mean, it was based on a price list. But, you know, there's lots of things that were up for interpretation and, you know, lots of details that can easily be missed if they're not written down, and a limited amount of space to actually write details. So it was tricky. I think changing that really, really, really helped our business.
But what did you do specifically to make it more standardized?
So we implemented a program called Leap to Digital. And it's actually called Sales Pro now, from Leap to Digital. And what it allows us to do is do all of our quoting and estimating and price building on an iPad on site. So we can go to the customer's house. We've broken down our price list into component parts, and the sales rep just needs to put in the sizes and the component parts into the iPad, and it will produce a professional standardized quote or contract on site within a couple of seconds. So that really helped us with standardizing pricing like that, because if the wrong number was in the box, then it's very easy to see and it wouldn't come together. So we found that by using that system, our GP really leveled up. So we've been running it exactly on target for gross profit for 3 years now.
Whereas before it was sort of hit and miss.
Yeah, completely hit and miss.
Okay. And then you talked about some standardized forms as well. Like, where do those fit into the overall handoff?
Well, we really use standardized forms for pre-construction. So in pre-construction, we try to separate the sales process from the actual building process and have like a nice transition in between. So one of our SOPs is that as soon as a project is sold, then the sales rep has to call the office and book another meeting where the customer, the sales rep, and the project manager for that project are going to be in attendance at the customer's house. So they're going to set that appointment, and that appointment encompasses like exactly what is going to happen, when it's going to happen, and how much it's going to cost. So that was really one of the original goals of our company, and one of our core values is the company is set up to take the stress out of building. So we like to offer our customers fixed timelines, fixed prices, and for them to know exactly what they're going to get. And we find if we can win on those fronts, then we've got a good chance of being successful.
What is the agenda of these pre-construction meetings? Like, I'm assuming they're fairly structured, they're fairly repeatable, there's kind of key points you're wanting to hit at every one.
Mm-hmm. So it's getting all of the details down on paper is like the main goal of them. But we have a standardized list of questions and standardized list of boxes that need to be filled. So this item is going here. It's going to be exactly this size. It's starting here and it's finishing here. And there's going to be footings here, here, and here, and stairs here, here, and here. This is the type of railing that this deck is going to have. This is the type of top surface this deck is going to have. This is the color it's going to be. Like all of the questions that we need to know in order to build it successfully. And it took a lot of trial and error to get those right, to get the lists correct. Mm-hmm. But I think we're in a pretty good place now.
Why do you think they work so well? I mean, why do you think they're a fundamental part of the solution that you've come up with?
Because using them and using the meetings has allowed us to take on more projects. So it's not possible. It's not possible for a company our size to run 500 projects if they're not, if most of them are not going smoothly. Like they've got to go smoothly. And we found that using them and using the system and procedure, that's really allowed us to just continue taking on more projects and keep everything rolling, keep everything flowing and moving forward.
But why do they, like, I guess what I'm curious about is it fundamentally about like an expectation setting thing with the customer? Like when you talk about making things go more smoothly, the reason things don't go smoothly 99 times out of 100 is the customer's not happy with what's happening. There's sometimes supply chain issues, weather can delay us, whatever, but most of the time it's an expectation not being met. So is the fundamental purpose of these pre-construction meetings to sort of hammer over the head explicitly with words and in writing to the customer, hey, this is exactly what your project is going to look like when we're finished?
Yeah, but it's not necessarily a negative sense like that.
No. It's not negative at all.
It's not like you're not going to get this one, you're going to get this one. It's not really like that. It's more like we're reassuring the customer and like having like a very strict understanding that this is what you're getting, this is when it's going to happen, and this is how much it's going to cost. And trying to, if there's any like nuances or things that we can see might be a problem along the way, discussing that.
Okay.
But I think, I think if they know those details that I listed, like you have a good chance, like if you can stick to that, you have a good chance of it working out. You really can.
And your sales guy, like your sales team, doesn't mind doing this. It's like one might listen to this and go, well, like, you know, my people are paid on commission. They would never go back and make an extra dive and an extra meeting. They don't mind too much.
They don't have a choice if they want to do it, to be totally honest with you, and nor do the project managers. It's a lot of work for everyone.
Yeah.
But it's less work doing that than having the project go sideways. Because there's only so many headaches that you can deal with. There's only so many problems you can deal with at any one time. And if you're doing the volume that we're aiming to do, then it gets really problematic very quickly.
The third thing that you invested in were really good quality SOPs for sales, for office, and then for sort of like the production methods on site. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I mean, I think for us, like doing lots of projects, lots of smaller projects like this, I think it's really, really essential to have everything standardized. So that everyone knows where we're at in the process and allows everyone to succeed. We also, on the production side, the company is very geared towards doing as much pre-preparation work as possible before starting the project. So with our Pergol units, for example, they're 100% prepared and constructed in our workshop. They're sanded, they're stained, they're cut to size, everything is made into a kit, and then we ship a kit to build it. So in order to do that, we need to have like quite strict and quite standard like product offerings and ways of communicating that.
That was another big move that you made as well. Going like, was it not the case that historically you would go and do all that stuff on site? You would sort of have a little factory or a little shop on site where you're doing the cuts, you're attaching everything together. You sort of have a mini factory in the field, and that was not working. And you've brought that sort of into your shop where you guys are located there.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, we. You know, some of our early projects, we were staining lumber and sanding lumber in customers' backyards and in December in Vancouver, which is very wet and cold and not much fun. Let me tell you, it doesn't really produce a very nice product at the end. It was definitely a conscious decision, actually quite early on, to move a lot of the production inside And we took it to another level a couple of years ago. We have a decent sized facility, and we produce a lot of lumber, a lot of pieces. And
can you make an estimate at sort of how much production capacity that has freed up, or how much more efficient that made you?
Yeah, at least 5 times. I would say closer to 10 times, especially for particular products. So we used to be like one carpenter and a helper would be able to produce a pergola in a week. So it would take them a week to go there, get the wood together, build it, sand it, stain it, do whatever they wanted to do with it, and then get out of there. And now one crew can do between 3 and 5 in a week, depending on the size. So we can definitely do more volume on site quicker. And that's been really, really useful for us.
When and how did it become very obvious to you to do that? Because that is a bit of a jump, right? You would have had to buy or lease some space, or you're not carrying some more overhead. There's some risk in doing this. It's not necessarily a proven idea. Was it a book you read? Was it somebody told you you needed to do this? Did you just come to it through your own thinking and logic? Like, how did you make that move from, these fairly inefficient, but it's a known quantity of, carpenters on site building stuff very, very manually, to a little bit more of a factory floor?
I mean, I think a lot of it honestly was spawned from the discontent of carpenters being forced to sand and stain wood on site.
Yeah.
And be out in the cold for extended periods. And they didn't want to do that work. And in my opinion, was not a good use of their time either. And I'm interested personally in, in flat pack furniture like IKEA and systems like that. I think they're genius. They take a lot of design and a lot of planning, but they really work. You can produce some really good stuff at low cost if you do it correctly. And that was definitely a goal for us to do that, and to stop using such expensive labor to do such menial tasks was a key factor.
Yeah, right. You're telling me, I'm tired of paying carpenters to stain pergolas. They're really expensive, right? And they're pretty at staining 100%. Pergolas. This is dumb.
Yeah. Yeah, there's painting crews out there that are way better, way faster, and do a much better job. Yeah.
How long did all this take to institute? Like, when you're thinking of the implementation process, none of this stuff happens overnight. It takes some commitment and some discipline and some fortitude over time. How long did it take you to figure out the standardized estimating, the pre-construction meetings, and the SOPs?
So it took about 2 years in total to really get that going in the right direction. I think that the pre-construction meetings were really the key to the success of our business. I took that from BTA, from our teachings at BTA and from interactions with our coach, and kind of ran with it that we needed to sort that problem out. And that was the key to having a chance of having a successful business. If we hadn't made those changes with estimating and pre-construction, we would still be doing the same thing. We would still genuinely be thinking we're doing a good job with low revenues, even lower GP, and very low net profit, if any. Like, I really believe that.
It's a pretty impressive turnaround, Charlie. On the note of morale, one of the things that I hear you do is you've got a whole bunch of plaques. You've got Google review plaques on the walls at the shop. You want to talk a bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, it's a really nice program that we run to encourage our team to be involved in doing a really good job for customers and going just that little extra, going that little extra for them and doing little extra things that make all the difference to a customer. So whenever we get a nice review, whether it be on Google or Facebook or any of the online platforms, we take a photo of the project. We frame it and we print out the review itself and put it up on the wall. in our staff room and in our offices. And we, any of the guys that are mentioned in the review, get a little bonus, right? So they get paid a management bonus. And that really helps for them to encourage the customers to do it. So they will do that extra little cleanup, whatever the customer wants, and then hopefully they'll talk about it and encourage the customer that it will help them out a little bit. So it's a nice way. We try to sell it to the customers as like a nice way to tip the team.
Mm.
So, hey, Mr. Customer, really glad you're happy. Would you mind giving us a quick Google review? Installer A and installer B were working on your project. Would you mind just mentioning them? Because then they get a little bonus on it, and it's really nice for them. They can go and move on to the next one. And that's quite powerful with actually getting the reviews in the first place.
Which part is powerful in helping get the reviews?
Asking them, and particularly asking them to help the staff.
The crews.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, rather than the company.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a really good idea.
I think customers are more likely to help the team that helped them than they are the whole company, especially if they see it. So.
Yeah, 100%.
Corporation or something.
100%. Yeah, yeah. No, they care about the workers that were on the site. So listen, through this whole journey and doing all this, one of the things that impresses us a ton with Plus Construction is you were able to hit your BHAG 2 years early, and it doesn't really even necessarily matter what it was and what was achieved, but the idea of like setting a big, hairy, audacious goal 5 years out and then eclipsing that 3 years ahead of schedule is really impressive. I'm wondering if there's anything that you have learned from that journey that you can share with our listeners.
I think setting targets and goals is one of the most important things you can ever do in your life. I'm a big fan of Zig Ziglar. He's my favorite author. I come from a sales background as well, so I really enjoy what he talks about. One of the things he says is, if you haven't got a target, how are you going to hit it? You got no chance of hitting it if you don't have a target. And it's true. Like you need to have your targets. And maybe when I set those BHAG targets, I was aiming too low, because I didn't believe in my head that it would be possible for it ever to work properly. But it is possible. You need to set the goals. You need to do something a little bit better every day in order to help you get closer to your goals. And it is definitely possible.
And maybe you set them a little bigger next time.
Sure.
Charlie, this is...
My goals are horribly big now. I don't know if I'll ever achieve them.
It's a good place to have them. Dude, thank you for the walkthrough on everything. I love what you're up to. I think the digital marketing funnel and really stabilizing your revenue is something a lot of contractors wish they had. And I hope that listeners learn a bit from that. But then I would say even more importantly is the work you've done to the production end of the business. Lead flow is nothing if you can't go and produce it. And that's an even bigger piece of the puzzle that you've figured out. So really want to thank you for your time today, Charlie. An awesome job.
You're welcome. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot for listening to this episode of Contractor Evolution. If you've already subscribed to our channel, consider sharing this episode with another contractor who you think needs to hear it.